Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. With us today, we have David Davies from AgUnity, which is a developing nations app, farming app, and also supported by blockchain. How are you going there today, David?
Very good, thanks. Pleased to be on the podcast, mate.
Well, pleasure. And hello, Carl, and how are you today, my friend?
Always well, Michael, and thank you very much. Hope you're all doing well as well.
Always, always. Well, we'll hand over to you, Carl, and kick off our first question.
Wonderful. David, thank you very much for joining us today. Now, you've had quite an interesting career. You've worked over Southeast Asia in the financial sector for a long period of time, well over a decade. You're now obviously the founder CEO of AgUnity, which is, you know, helping developing nations to make farming more efficient and accessible technology for farmers in those countries as well. So tell us a bit about your story on how, you know, you swapped out of the financial sector and across to doing something which is, you know, quite noble that you are doing now.
Well, it's actually kind of a full circle story because I grew up in a, you know, remote farming area of outback Australia, wheat and sheep farming area. Never really saw, you know, farming is really marginal in Australia. So it's a hard job for very little money. So I gravitated towards technology. Spent most of my life working in technology until 96, 97, when I found out how to run a UNESCO, or how to put in a bid for a UNESCO project, and it got funded, or partly funded. So I spent a year in West Africa documenting the UNESCO World Heritage Sites, very interestingly, with a powered paraglider. So I was actually filming from the air over places like Timbuktu, Dogon Escarpment, Ildigori, Bank de Arguin, like really fascinating places that back in the 90s hadn't been really well covered. And that's kind of, you know, a foundation to why we did AgUnity, because, you know, we saw very closely, you know, what the farmers in, what the life of farmers in Mali is, and why cooperation, which wasn't happening there, is so important compared to Australia. So, you know, after Africa, I ended up in Japan, had a company there, which that was in the early days of the iMode phones by Docomo. So Japan had the first web browsing phones, but being Japan, there were three mobile networks and they were completely different. So we built a middleware product, and that company eventually got acquired by a company called Stellant, which is a NASDAQ listed company in the US that was looking to learn new, you know, learn how to do mobile tech and also get a foothold in Japan. And then I got invited to come and work at Goldman Sachs and built a system for, built a system called Technology My Desk for them. And then ended up at, they offered to move me to New York. And I don't really like New York. So I instead moved 10 floors downstairs to exactly the same desk in Lehman Brothers and ran treasury technology. Kind of bad call that one, because I was running treasury technology right up until the crash. And anyone knows the background of that. When the music stopped, all the money was in Asia. So we were sitting on every cent Lehman had in the world within the treasury systems. And yeah, after that, I other people from Lehman and Goldman ended up at Standard Chartered Bank in Singapore, and I became global head of market data control at Standard Chartered for 5 years. And I had another company that I'd kind of set up prior to that, but that also got acquired. And that sort of leads to how AgUnity started, because we were working on a blockchain tech. We were building a type of blockchain technology. And I say that specifically. It was something, if you imagine something between blockchain and BitTorrent, it was more of a communication protocol than a actual, you know, if you consider blockchain like a database almost, this was more how you live transfer data. And it was aimed at competing with Bloomberg and Reuters. So we'd spent a good couple of years, like over $500,000 building that technology. And we happened to get invited to a conference in London. And John, who's one of the founders, he went across and turned up on the Friday, bags in hand, found out there was a hackathon on over the weekend, and then he called me up and said, hey, there's this prize from Singularity University. And, you know, I've always been a fan of Peter Diamandis, Ray Kurzweil, and their big thinking ideas. So we brainstormed on that and said, look, what's the biggest world-changing idea that we can come up with in order to win this prize? And literally that's all we were thinking of, like how to win a hackathon. And over the course of that weekend, we were talking to a cooperative in India and another one in South Africa. And we were getting really strong feedback that what we were proposing, which was really simple because it was just a hackathon idea, was actually had, you know, they valued it highly. And, you know, that idea was just low-cost mobile phone, blockchain, so the transactions are securely recorded, and make something that just records basic farmers' transactions to improve the cooperation and trust. And so, yeah, look, we won that. And fortunately, Costa Peric, who ran financial inclusion for Gates Foundation, he was there and he beelined John after it. And he said, look, this is a great idea. We see this problem all over the world. You guys just nailed it. We want you to take it seriously. Come to us if you need help. We're still yet to do a Gates Foundation project, but they were the ones that encouraged us at first. So we've got a couple of bids in for Gates Foundation grants coming up, but we've been in contact with them all along. But it was their inspiration that they validated that what we did. They thought it could be big. And then when we circulated the idea around other NGOs and other commodity buyers that we knew, we realized that we were onto something that not a lot of people had really thought through in the way of how to solve it, or not a lot of people could build the right solution for.
Amazing. And the interesting thing you speak about there was having that global idea, or turning it into a global vision. And do you think sometimes coming, you know, from an Australian perspective, a lot of people are trying to solve a problem that's, you know, more of a localized one than trying to go out and sort of tackle the world? Is there a bit more conservative nature with a lot of people in Australia when they're looking like that?
No, oh, there's definitely, and there's a bit of a self-reinforcing prophecy in Australia with that, in that the investors and the incubators and that do tend to get you thinking local. It's a very different to the reaction you get from investors in Silicon Valley. They're always telling us we're undervalued. Australian, you know, investors going, oh, it's a bit expensive. So yeah, the whole ecosystem in Australia is kind of geared around that local thinking, and then we'll take it out to one market maybe. And what you say not only applies to Australia, I think it applies to the whole impact investment community as well. I think impact investment, the founders tend to think small, like I'm going to solve this problem in Kenya and I'm going to do it really well in Kenya. And the investors tend to go with the flow on that, like show us your results in this one place. There's not a lot of companies that go, ah, I'm going to change the whole world. I'm going to, you know, why do it for a million people when you can do it for a billion people? And a lot of the solutions, you know, could be scaled. And I think it would be, you know, much better for the world if more companies did try to think big in that way. I think there's appetite for it. And impact companies can be just as profitable and get as good returns as any others if they do try to scale it. You know, there's immense opportunity in the developing world markets.
Interesting.
Yeah, and from your perspective, David, obviously the solution revolves around, you know, Agunity providing, you know, basically smart devices in the form of mobile phones with preloaded software designed effectively to assist, you know, developing nations' farmers' life. What countries at the moment are you guys currently dealing with? Obviously, you mentioned Kenya, but have you got a few other target markets you're working with at the moment as well?
Yeah, we've deployed in 7 countries at the moment. We've got about another dozen on the go. So Kenya, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone, in Africa. We've got a project in Trinidad, Papua New Guinea. We did a small project in Solomon Islands as well. And then we've got the ones on the go are Indonesia, Colombia, another one in Ethiopia, or actually another 2 in Ethiopia now, Uganda, I mentioned Colombia, and yeah, there are a few other spotted around the place. So yeah, it's this year has been a real growth year for us, partly due to COVID. We had a bit of initiative because one of the things we can do is help countries shut down the food markets in a pandemic and keep foods moving. If you're a country like, say, Uganda, you really can't shut the food markets because you'll literally starve people. I mean, if food supply stops moving, you know, farmers aren't earning money, and the people in the urban areas are relying on that informal food supply chain, which goes from market to market. But food markets, as anyone can imagine, that's like the hotbed for spreading a virus. And you've got people coming from the small villages into a market with their goods for the day and potentially coming back with the virus. So the obvious alternative to that is, you know, use the phone. I've got some taro and pineapple. Someone come into the village and pick up my goods in a sanitized way, give me a fair price for it, and then get that food into the city. So we're doing a few initiatives like that, and that's really, you know, accelerated our move into a few markets.
That's fantastic. So when it comes to these developing nations and the farmers themselves, what's it like for the farmer? Like, what sort of problems have they got? You know, what does their day look like?
Yeah, look, it's you see some very common themes all around the world. I mean, and quite a few of them, the big philanthropists, speak to this much better than I do, but they're primary challenge is they often try to do everything on their own. You know, if they need to buy a herbicide or something like that, they're trying to buy just enough, and they're often, you know, getting the wrong advice. When they're selling half a bag of coca beans. They're never going to get a good price for that. There's always middlemen in the way. So it's that the fundamental thing we do is actually really simple. We enable the farmers to trust each other in their like local community or cooperative and trust the buyer or the, you know, the whoever's buying their produce and cooperate better. And even those two concepts are really simple, you know, they are life-changing for these farmers. And that's really the major struggle they have. And their life is really incredibly hard in that they're often only, you know, they literally have no spare money. So what they sell today is what their kid, you know, is what going to pay for their kids to eat tonight. And even a small increase in their income can make a profound difference, because when you're sort of hand to mouth all the time, you don't have the opportunity to say, buy some extra seedlings for the farm, buy, you know, coca and coffee farmers, right? Almost always you can grow vanilla with coffee and cocoa. You get a secondary crop, you get a secondary income, and all they need is some seedlings and a bit of know-how. It's like, you know, maybe $100, and they can have perhaps a couple of $1,000s, but certainly many hundreds of dollars per year after a few years. Usually they lack even the basic money to invest that much to get on the thing, to get on the ladder upwards. And we see that problem all over. So one of the key things we do is get that cooperation happening, give them access to, you know, vanilla seedlings or access to that when they've got money. And that's another real big problem that they have. So particularly women farmers, I mean, and it's important to note, about 50% of farmers are women. So the slight majority of farmers are women, and they tend to be at a double disadvantage. And when they get cash, there's often a lot of people in the family that will turn up and want it for some reason. And so one of their big challenges is if they've got income, they don't want to bring it home. They want to be able to spend it, or they want to be able to hold it somewhere. But if you haven't got a clear record of it, leaving that in the cooperative or leaving it with the buyer, you might lose the money. So they're taking cash home. They risk getting robbed on the way home because, you know, if you're a woman farmer carrying a bag of coffee into the cooperative to hand it over, everybody knows you're coming back with a couple of hundred dollars of cash. And when you turn up at the house, everyone turns up and wants some money for something, and they've all got great reasons. And it's particularly difficult for the women to resist that. So one of the very important things we do is just allow them to keep the money in the cooperative and order something that they really wanted, like the seedlings or the most transformative thing is solar lighting kits. And one amazing thing is, no matter how far you go out into the village, I mean, we get to some really remote places that are like, you know, bush track. Even the farmers up in those areas, they know they would like a solar kit. They don't want to use kerosene lamps. They don't want their kids, you know, if anyone's ever seen it, you see kids like holding a kerosene lamp this close to their face and the book here, trying to study at night because they don't want to use too much kerosene and they're breathing kerosene fumes. It's just atrocious. And, you know, cooking in the house and when it's raining and stuff. You know, a solar kit is transformative. It pays for itself in about 3 months. And the problem isn't they can't get them. It's the problem is when they've got the money, it goes too quickly. They can't actually get an order in. So they all know they want them. And it's just a matter of fulfilling that ability for them to put money aside and order it while they've got the money and get those, get better kits into the villages.
That's fantastic. And with that in mind, obviously you're talking about going to market. Okay. So when they're at market, they're at risk with their money or taking goods to the market. What about the logistics side? So if a farmer does hand off some crops to logistics companies, some unethical behavior maybe takes some of that those goods and sells them on the black market. Is that one of the things you guys address?
Yeah, it's probably not the most major one. The biggest one is actually waste, particularly in our industry. So, I mean, one of the things that's the phone we tend to deploy. This is a waterproof one, and that's set up in the real basic functionality there with like the big obvious icons. Yeah. One of the most important things around cacao industry is that, you know, for anyone that's not seen cacao, it comes in a pod like this, and there's about 20 slimy beans, look like big white baked beans, basically. And you open the pod, you get those beans, and farmers will typically put them in, say, an old rice bag, and they'll have some rice bags sitting beside the road. If you haven't got a reliable way of getting them picked up and purchased, they start to rot in about 2 to 3 days. And in Papua New Guinea, we were seeing up to half the coca beans just rotting like that. And then if they weren't rotting in the bags, they were rotting on the trees because the farmers they'd harvest one time, they wouldn't sell their crop, and they'd go, oh, why should I do it again? I might not sell it. So the most important thing you can do is just make sure that when the farmer's got coca beans, they can say, hey, I've got something to pick up. The cooperative guy knows where the coca beans are and can go around, collect them up on time. What the next steps in that process is you take the coca beans and you put them in fermentation boxes for about a week, and then you lay them out and dry them, and you end up with, just happen to have a bag of coca beans on my desk, you end up with that type of product. Which is worth about 3 times more than the green product. So we benefit the farmers in 2 ways. We stop the wastage, which is, you know, in the really small farmers, the amount of coca beans that get wasted is just tragic. And then we make sure that the cooperative is doing the fermentation and drying process to the best standards because it's much easier to train them as a group. And then they're probably getting 3 times as much value when the cooperative sells them, and the farmer gets a notice on his app saying, hey, you know, your coca beans just sold, you've got 200 kina, either come into the cooperative and collect your money or collect part of your money, or what, you know, they can use it, treat the cooperative a bit like a bank, or we'll just go ahead and order that solar lighting kit that you already put an order in for and come and collect it next time you're in. And that commerce part is really important. I mean, you obviously these farmers have no credit cards, they have no bank accounts, they couldn't use Amazon or eBay, but they have exactly the same needs we do, like all the things we want. And we take eBay and Amazon and the fact that we've got a Kmart near us for granted. You know, some of the farmers, Solomon Islands was particularly obvious like this, that the farmers would have to travel a full day to get to a major city where they could buy anything. We were hearing stories of the teachers shut the school for 2 days a month just to travel to pick their paycheck up. And that, you know, that's another system that we, you know, ultimately will extend beyond the farmers to the teachers so they can have the app and they can get the money into the app and then they can use it locally. And so we can avoid the, you know, schools shutting for days for an unnecessary boat trip into a village.
Yeah, it's really interesting you mentioned that because, like you said, these are people who have, like, you know, a very good skill set when it comes to, you know, growing, harvesting and understanding the life cycle of their crop, but are, again, kind of held back by the fact that, you know, these technological solutions aren't really available in a lot of ways. So, like you said, communication, you know, is often done via potentially, there might be some cell towers available, there might not be, But if you're working on a farm that's very remote and you have to communicate with your neighbor in order to build a bilateral relationship, you know, it's incredibly difficult to do so. So, I mean, obviously you guys are tackling big problems, but I mean, are you kind of breaking it down into, you know, like you said, working with, you know, localized food banks to act as kind of like a central, almost like a, I guess, a reserve food bank for laboring farmers, and increasing levels of communication and education? Is that kind of like the first step before moving on to the next phase?
Yeah, look, the first step is you've got to be, and that's why I sort of showed that one. That's the most basic one. And we always start out the farmer with the really basics. I've got some crop. I need to tell someone to come and collect it. I'm handing over the crop. And one of the things we did on the phones is we built kind of a message bus, like TIPCO, if anyone's familiar with it, so that when they do a transaction, if there's no communications at the time, they can do the transaction using QR codes phone to phone. They both get an encrypted transaction and it goes in the queue. And so when, say, the guy goes back to the cooperative, his transaction will go back. We'll trust that one. And we've got situations where the farmers have never actually been online. They can use the whole system without actually ever connecting the phone to a network. It's really a remote data collection device. And then finally, the third thing that we always put on there is the ability to get cash out, of course. So those three functions we start with, and then we include services like the shop, the marketplace, the ability to tell people you've got produce to sort of line up orders. So we do a bit of process flow around it. And then ultimately we can connect them to education. Kids love the phone, of course. So we're putting in, we're building some what we call Aquiot Towers, which is a solar-powered tower we put in the village. It's got a street light at night for a very dim street light, but in a dark village, that's a really important safety feature. If something domestic violence is happening, just having somewhere bright that people can go is a really important measure. And those towers provide connect to the cellular network, provide Wi-Fi around the village so farmers don't need a data plan. And then we put a lot of useful materials on that so they don't have to have, you know, an online, you know, data plan in order to get some education for the kids, some songs and stuff like that. And we're very fortunate that Dr. Campbell is actually, if anyone knows, Dr. Campbell's a very prominent YouTube celebrity that has a year's worth of educational material on medical things. So he's offered to put all that on the towers, and we're working with a few others that'll have a whole education suite to make just better use of the phones.
That's fantastic. I mean, so it's sort of starting in the agricultural space, but really it's basically providing essential life services as well. Like, you know, and it's interesting you mentioned that before, because I think that's a lot of things we take for granted now. If I don't know something, I can jump on YouTube quickly and go, oh, that's how I build a fastener or whatever it might be. But for a lot of these people remotely, like, the things we're taking for granted obviously aren't available. So I think it's a fantastic enterprise. The other thing I wanted to ask you was, obviously, Australia is a very interesting one from an agricultural space. Obviously, you're based in Australia as well. Should we really be producing a lot more tech than we are in the agriculture space, considering, you know, the arable land that we have, considering, you know, we're a fairly wealthy nation and we do have a lot of technology skills? But at the moment, you know, we're not really leading that space. So what do you think are some of the reasons behind this?
Oh, yeah, look, we know this. I know the answer to this one really well. Look, Australia, so much of the world is semi-arid, which Australia is the leading example. I mean, European countries could not develop technologies as well as Australia could that were useful for Africa or other arid regions of the world. So we're in a key position for that. But having been a participant in many, you know, global challenges, and, you know, we were Agripreneur of the Year and we were a presenter of that. So we know three cohorts of the Future Agro Challenge, which is over 100 companies per year. We're part of the Dubai Expo Live program, which is 400 companies. So we know most of them. You've got to look at countries like Israel and Netherlands. The amount of support of really targeted good investment to drive the growth of those companies and then export their technologies that happens in those two nations in particular compared to Australia is like day and night. Australia has good support programs, but we really need, you know, Australia should be funding our farmers and our technology companies that support them to become leaders in things like regenerative farming. I mean, Australia could kill the world on that because we've got the arid space. We can do soil regeneration techniques. We can do low loss irrigation, all those technologies. We can perfect them and then take them to half the world. So Australia becomes the leader. And those are things that, you know, Israel might be able to do it a bit, but Netherlands and European countries can't do that. So it would be great to see, you know, Australia at a federal level or even a state level investing much more in enabling those technologies to lead the way in Australia, because they'll get the results. You just need to fund them. You need to fund them for a couple of years so that, you know, 5 years down the track, the farmer's got an improved farm and yield and he's been able to pay the cost back. But you need that investment initially to be able to take on these new initiatives. And we do a lot more around, you know, Australian government invests a lot more around the mining sector and, you know, roadways and other infrastructure than it does in agriculture. And, you know, Australia is an agricultural society in many, many ways. We could do so much more with it. Yeah. Increasing our own yield and then becoming a leader in the world. I think that's the place Australia should rightly hold.
Well, the yield thing is interesting because, I mean, there's been talks for a long time about, you know, people saying, hey, we should be basically the food bowl for Asia. We have, you know, a huge amount of land. We have the capacity, the capability, the people, the technology and the infrastructure, which a lot of it has been built by, you know, mines that are no longer used, whether it's railways or road, which could be leased or whatever else. But instead, we seem to be seeing more foreign multinationals coming in and actually buying up, you know, large farms, and it seems to be going in a bit of a backwards way. So do you think maybe from a government perspective, there's not enough interjection there to say, hey, we need a national project at the farming level to really have a future vision for the next 20 to 30 years once mining starts to, I guess, derail a bit?
Absolutely. And one of the massive problems we have in Australia is just we deplete our natural resources. I mean, guilty as charged. We're a wheat and sheep farm. We, you know, we're harvesting as much as we could every year, growing often the same crop in a field year on year, a lot of monocropping. There's better techniques. There's much better ways to do that. And specifically looking at the Murray-Darling Basin and the amount of water that's wasted on that because we've handed out the water rights in the wrong way. Those are really fixable solutions. There's really good technologies that can address it. And it's just a kind of catch-22 problem for the farmers. I mean, farmers should be moving to low-loss irrigation in Australia en masse, and all they need is a funding program to do it. And unfortunately, you know, banks aren't too kind to Australian farmers. So it's hard for the farmers to do it on its own, but there's a huge return if the government does it, because, you know, if you're putting more into your land, the land becomes an increasing value asset, whereas most of Australia at the moment is reducing the value of land by, you know, overuse, basically overuse and poor irrigation.
There seems to also be, I guess, sorry, Mike to interrupt, but the one thing I also wanted to point out and get your opinion on, David, is there also seems to be what's the best way to put it? A lot of people are kind of very standoffish when it comes to, you talk about, you know, helping farmers through drought, helping, you know, them with aid packages. They're like, well, you know, I don't get any aid packages in my job, blah, 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 whatever it might be. But it seems like there's almost a bit of, you know, content now for the farming industry, which is quite strange in a kind of divide and conquer way. But have you found that as well, that people kind of go, oh, you know, farming grants, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You know, they chose to go on the land, they should deal with it. Like, have you sort of run into that sort of attitude as well? Because I seem to find it when I speak to quite a few people that seems to be the default response. Usually people, obviously, from a city background as well.
Yeah, and I think it's fairly poorly understood, and then it's poorly implemented when the grants go. I mean, there are lots of grants in Australia for farming, but they're often to continue unsustainable practices. I mean, the money should be going into what is looking, as you said, look, what's looking 5 to 10 years ahead, and what's going to make those farms productive and viable, not today, and not keep the zombie farms alive, which there are a lot of, but turn those farms into productive, highly productive acreage, which we can absolutely do. I mean, 20 years ago, the technology didn't exist. Today, it does. It exists in mass. There's many complementary technologies can be used, and we could be transforming Australia today. And it's that sort of investment that should happen. And that sort of investment, if conveyed right to the urban centres, they'll understand it because they're getting, you know, fresher produce. They're getting, you know, better, good, you know, healthier produce, and that can be marketed well. It just requires the government to, like, you know, fully get behind a proper program in agriculture, because, you know, I have to say it's the biggest long-term opportunity for Australia. It's not, doesn't look like we're going to change the world in technology or other areas, and that's going to be high competitive. It's the one thing that we can really excel at.
Exactly. And look, I did a bit of research on the Western Australian government. Obviously, they want to invest a lot more in being a food bowl, right? Obviously, using the infrastructure out of there to Asia. But last numbers I looked at from the Australian Bureau of Statistics was about $60 billion a year, a commitment to GDP of agriculture producers, where obviously mining's over $100 billion. And by 2030, it's supposed to hit $100 billion. Mm. Yeah. Now, I'm not actually clear how we're going to get there with that number and get above it, right? Obviously, you mentioned before is using the land and sustainable land and energy. Love that one. Obviously, using our arid land to produce more food, maybe putting greenhouses on there. Now, we had a previous guest who discussed this last week, but what do you reckon? What do you reckon is a major driver to get us over the $100 billion if we really want to be on the world stage?
The really sad thing is the way that we're going to do it at the moment is producing more of the same in the inefficient ways. Just, you know, I know this, we're from a very marginal area of South Australia, right up in the near the Victoria, New South Wales corner. So a lot of our property was, you know, not good, not really good for anything. You could run sheep on it once every couple of years, but wasn't much good. So much of Australia is like that. But with good management, you can quickly turn that land around. They're doing it in Middle East at the moment. They're like they're turning desert back into really fertile land, not only with greenhouses, but just with, you know, soil regeneration techniques, you know, algae farms producing better inputs to the soil, and then using proper irrigation on it, you turn essentially desert into soil. And Australia is much closer to the target than that. We only need to fix things a little bit. But where I think they're going to get most of that gain is they're seeing, you know, increasing beef consumption in China, and they're just going to run more beef in Australia. It's, you know, you could probably double our output in beef in Australia, but ultimately you're depleting the land, and that ends badly. So there's something really important that needs to be thought about, and unfortunately we don't always as a country think far enough ahead as to how that these outcomes are going to have, how what the outcome of our policies today is going to have in 5 or 10 years.
Do you think there needs to be a bit of, I don't know if regulation is the right word, but the one thing you mentioned there was, chasing the market. So say if there's a expanding market for pork, beef, or anything in regards to livestock. But obviously there's been a bit of a backlash recently around, you know, the vegan movement's started to jump a lot higher. More people are looking at plant-based alternatives. So does there need to be a bit of intervention regarding, you know, the livestock to, you know, whether it's vegetable or fruit production instead? Do we need to put a cap on it? Is it something that, you know, does do a lot of destruction to the land base that we do have?
So livestock is very good when it's in a mixed environment. So if you're running, you know, different types of grazing animals, and then you're cycling crops on a particular field, that can become a really healthy field, and it can sustain like a large herd of animals, and of mixed animals as well. The problem is that doesn't normally happen. It's inefficient for the farmers to operate that way. And it's hard to make, it's costly to make that initial change. And once you do make the change and you've got, you know, irrigation systems in, you know, et cetera, and you've increased the soil value, it works very, very well. And, you know, this has been proven all around the world. It's just, you need to make it very, you know, Australian farmers, I grew up, all my neighbours that way, they're very resistant to change, and they're particularly resistant to putting money, you know, they're often one drought away from being in a very serious situation. So and droughts in Australia are sort of a 9-year occurrence roughly. So all the neighbours around me, they'd be very reluctant, even though they've got hundreds of thousands of dollars to invest in their farm, to put that into something unless there was some support around it. If they can get that support and then get to pay it back over time, perfectly viable situation. And you can make the economics work. It's just our government doesn't seem to think that, you know, doesn't seem to have that mindset, which is, it's quite interesting given that, you know, certainly the National have really close connection to Australian farmers, but they seem to be winning sound bites rather than actually thinking about long-term policies and convincing their electorates that they're the party that's looking after the future of Australian farming. They tend to get focused more on, you know, koala protection in instances and stuff, which is, you know, they could be a lot more. I mean, we grew up in a National Party area, and I always thought that they should be doing a lot more for Australian farmers.
And how do you look? And also, obviously, you mentioned the Australian government, the state government. So when you do look at the investment, obviously, the federal government looks at infrastructure, water, and maintaining the sustainability of that area, and logistics, of course, of moving goods around the country and out of the country. The state governments pick up the innovation kind of agenda, I've noticed, when I've done a bit of research. Does the weight of the innovation agenda when it comes to agriculture fall onto private sector, private investment, high net worth, family offices? What's your thoughts on that one?
There's fairly good support at sort of the seed stage level. There's lots of, you know, there's incubators and stuff. The gap in Australia is when you get to scaling. It's when you need a couple of million dollars to scale a business and you've got a good story for it, but there's still some risk involved. What I think would be extremely helpful is, you know, there's various countries around the world that have got sort of government guarantees. Like if you invest in this business, we'll underwrite your loss or something. It's very low cost for the government, but it gives investors the opportunity to take greater risks because they've been underwritten to a certain degree. I think as we sort of started in this initial discussion, when we're talking about investment in Australia and impact investment, coming from banking and having a large exposure to that, the really obvious thing is the risk appetite in Australia. And that's something the government can definitely do, is make, is encourage the investors to be a little bit more comfortable with risk by taking away a little bit of the downside of those projects.
And do you feel that the superannuation system has a part to play in that also, maybe exposing some parts of risk in that to give access to that funding, maybe?
Yeah. Look, if you underwrote, if the government gave some level of partial guarantee on investments into startup or innovation or expanding companies, then people could invest out of their super funds without the risk of losing the whole thing. So you open up a whole range more of the conservative capital because it's got a little bit of a... It's got a stop loss on the risk, basically.
No, definitely. And just and also just to change the subject a bit, obviously, with your involvement with the World Food Program and other programs, obviously, understanding how you interact with them with Ag Unity, what part do you play with them?
Oh, so we're complementary to them. So most of your large NGOs around the world aren't particularly adept at technology. Like, it's not really what they're set up for. We come from, you know, a couple of our founders also come from investment banking with me and were very high-end technologists. Although it's really just a phone and it's a simple super app, there's a lot of complexity to building it in this way that most of the app developers would not take that approach. So we basically, for the NGOs, they have a desperate need to get better information and better connectivity to the people they're trying to work with. So World Food Program's helping 9 million people around the world, like 9 million smallholder farmers around the world. They rarely know what's really happening with those farmers. They'll be supporting something at a regional level, making sure that, you know, say coffee in Ethiopia, that farmers are getting a fair price. But they're doing that by making sure the cooperative's getting a fair price. Whether that's being passed to the farmer, they've got no idea. Whether the farmer's kids are working picking the coffee, no idea. How much what the farmers are actually using that money on and what other problem they have. They usually don't have visibility into this. They'll send people out into the field once in a while to survey, but by the time they get those results back, it's often 18 months to 2 years before they've got meaningful information that they can look to adapt a program with. We can basically allow that to happen in real time. So these icons, these change, and we can push them down to the phone without the farmer having to do updates. So one of the very common things we do is create survey applications. So if you tell us what your kids are eating and how long they went to school for today, and you fill this in every day, we'll give you a slightly better price on your coffee. Compliance rate is off the charts high. Like, farmers often got very little to do at night. They're very happy to fill in a form for 5 cents extra, and the NGO knows exactly what the problems are. And that's the main thing, right? You know, the kids have to work on the farm because I can't send them to school because I need the extra money because I'm working somewhere else. Like, people don't... One of the interesting things we notice, right? You know, people, this whole child labor thing, almost no farmer wants their kids to work. They all want them to go to school and university. It's because they need to. And this is where the NGOs can play a real important part, making sure they get some funding to get the kids to school, making sure they got assistance to pick the crop when they need to, they've got a good supply chain. There's ways you can fix that if you understand what the problem is. And usually the challenge is they don't really have a good grip on the scope of the problem or where the actual problem is. And that's what we try to achieve by giving them better information.
That information store, how you develop it on the app, for example, is that all stored on the blockchain, or is that stored in a normal database from a technology point of view?
It's a normal database. We actually use the blockchain in the simplest way. It runs parallel to our normal system. The data in the normal system is encrypted with the farmer's own security key. So one of the things I'm extremely proud of is we are the opposite to Facebook. We don't own anyone's data. We'll transport it. So we'll basically, if the farmer wants a bank to have their data, we'll let the bank have access to it. But we don't own that data. So the data is encrypted in both our databases, and then we make a backup of all transactions on the blockchain. And what the blockchain does is give you this immutable transaction log. And it literally is just that. It's a transaction log. So everything that's in the database can be traced back to a transaction that came in, and that transaction will show up in the transaction log, which works very similar, for anyone that's familiar with accounting, to an accounting journal. There's always two matching transactions, and you can match up any side. So there's one from the cooperative, one from the farmer, or one from the farmer, one from the solar lighting company, and they all match up. And it's really just a long log of matched transactions.
And that's undisputable transparency and accountability, obviously, to your solution, which they didn't have before, right? You've empowered them to have that, right?
Exactly. And you could run our whole system without the blockchain, but the blockchain provides a very important security to farmers, because we tell them, no matter what happens, once you've handed over your coca beans and you've done the transaction on the phone, nobody can ever change that, not even AgUnity. That transaction is in the blockchain forever. And that gives them a sense of security, which all comes back to this trust. Once they know that no one can fiddle that transaction, they're happy for the cooperative to hang on to their money, because they know that they can't come back in 2 weeks and someone says, oh, you took the money out already. We can prove that didn't happen.
That's fantastic. Oh, sorry, Carl, I just cut you off there for the question, mate. You want to go?
No, that's all right. I was just thinking, so it's very interesting. So from your side, David, obviously there's the problem-solving perspective that you're tackling head on, but the other side is also a really good way of collecting much needed data back from these areas through technology to then look at what services and roadmap needs to be planned over the next, you know, 5 or so years as well. So is that starting to now become obviously much more important as part of the solution?
Yeah, so that's the very important part of the solution from the NGO side of things, which is, the NGOs probably represent about 20-25% of our business. The biggest one is actually commodity buyers. So Fairtrade's not technically a commodity buyer, but they best fit the bill. And Fairtrade has a really unique problem in that they're a great organization. They, just for anyone that doesn't understand how Fairtrade works, if you want to buy ethically sourced coffee, for example, and that coffee buyer has to get Fairtrade certification. Fairtrade will go out and prove that check with all the farmers that they're being paid properly for it, and they will then let that coffee company brand their coffee as fair trade. That coffee pays a premium to fair trade, and fair trade puts 50% of that back into the village, which they let the villagers vote on what they want to use it for. So if they want a new school, or they want a hospital, or they want the road repaired, fair trade will just spend it on whatever they want. So they get ways to, they get a fair price for what they're getting, and they get this premium devoted into them. Unfortunately, what's been happening lately is lots of other brands have come out and said, or lots of brands have figured out, we don't need to pay fair trade that money. We can just stick a logo on our thing that says it's ethically sourced. How does a consumer know? You know, you can be buying sustainable coffee, and it's just because the company put a brand on it, and we are living in the world of fake news and misinformation now, and anyone can say what they want and there's no way to prove it. So what we do in the case of ethical commodity buyers is we can trace those produce because we're collecting the information from the farmer, and that's the critical point. If you're not collecting it at the farmer level, you really can't solve the rest of the supply chain. So we can track it at the farmer. Once the coffee goes into a bag, we can put an IoT device in the bag. They're really low cost now. We can track it all the way to Germany. The coffee company can unbag it, put QR codes on it, and ultimately will be the stage where you buy a bag of coffee or you go to your coffee shop and on your receipt there's a QR code, and that'll tell you exactly where your coffee came from, which farmer grew it, what the organization has done in that village, so what the farmer's life's like. I mean, Fairtrade are actually hoping to have a massive social media campaign around this, that you can go and see the farmer's village, see what their house is like, you know, see the conditions they're living under, and most importantly, see what's improving because you're buying that coffee. And I think that's a real interesting way of changing consumer behavior from, look, I don't know what this is really doing, so I actually know the farmer and I know it's a real farmer. And then what I'm hoping to do soon after that is enable people to be able to tip the farmer. So, you know, I just think that's a wonderful story. I mean, I go into a coffee shop in Germany, I have a morning coffee, I look up the farmer that grew it, I send them a tip, and hopefully if they, on the app, they say thank you in real time, which just, you know, it's a lovely way to have a morning coffee, and who wouldn't spend an extra euro or dollar to interact with a farmer in, say, New Guinea while you're having a morning coffee.
100%. So, you know, utilizing technology to create a much more personalized experience. And I think you did raise an interesting point there, Dave, which is that the supply chain, like for a lot of people, is very much unknown. It's kind of a black box, right? They buy a product, but everything that sits behind it, you know, isn't really transparent in that way. So by using things like blockchain and IoT, you can say, well, no, I can guarantee that, you know, this device was packed in Colombia, in Papua New Guinea, wherever it was. It went through three sets of hands. It's now at the factory, but you can basically be guaranteed that, yes, this is where it was grown, and it was grown sustainably or by someone who, you know, would appreciate your help. And hey, here's a QR code. So I think that's a fantastic initiative. And it's being done today, as we've seen with things like Uber, you know, where you can tip the driver directly. So that technology does exist. So there really is no reason not to go ahead and implement it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it couldn't be more important in the case of low-income farmers because, you know, a €1 tip is potentially more than they got for a couple of kilograms of coffee. Hopefully not, but you know, hopefully they're getting a fair price. But, you know, very small tips that you could give to the farmer could make a major difference. But I think the most important thing is just people in the West actually starting to get an understanding of what these farmers' lives are like and feel that connection. Because I think then people become driven to buy more actual fair trade coffee and actual more sustainable goods. There's a lot of good companies around, but right now their problem is just how do they show the consumer they're really doing good? Mars is another one making fantastic initiatives, but again, trouble just showing the difference why a Mars chocolate bar is so much better than a Nestle one. And they fundamentally are a much better company.
Oh, Nestle is a bit of a dirty word, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of the worst kept secret in the agriculture space. So I don't think we should even give them any airtime. The one thing I did also wanted to talk about, David, was coming back to the localized situation. And like we know a lot of farmers here work incredibly hard. It's a very challenging climate. But in regards to supply chain, we've got a very unique situation, don't we? I mean, we've got two big players in the supermarket space who kind of have a lot of the buying power. So is this something, again, that you mentioned before about changing the consumer's behavior. Is that something I think, you know, we need to look at here as well, where maybe paying a bit extra for your produce, you know, will actually have a positive benefit and flow through back to the farmer, and implementing ways that we can also track that here too?
Yeah, that's Australia has a particular problem in this because of the duopoly and the dominance that those two, the two major supermarket chains have. We were a founder and we built the technology platform for a company called Escobox, which had a major contract with one of those to do traceability of produce. What to me was horribly disappointing about that is that supermarket chain, it's one of the big ones, they could easily reduce, like they reject about $700 million worth of produce at their DCs every year by visual inspection. Like, you know, look at a pallet of mushrooms and they'll go, oh, these, a couple of these are a bit brown, we'll send it back. In the case of the spoilable goods, mangoes and mushrooms, frequently that means it gets sold out, you know, thrown out, because the mushroom grower ends up with a pallet of mushrooms in a different state that he's got to figure out something to do with. By tracking that produce better and knowing the temperature it's been at and knowing where it's been, they can eliminate a lot of that problem. Unfortunately, that wasn't the impression, that wasn't what the supermarket chains wanted to care about. They seemed to think that that was an opportunity for them to put more pressure on the suppliers to fix their thing rather than fix the food waste issue, which was obviously the bigger opportunity. But again, I think it's something about the duopoly that they are more concerned about having fresher goods and loyalty of customers than actually removing the waste in their supply chain. So France has done great things on this. I mean, if supermarkets and suppliers throw goods out, they actually have to pay for it. Like, there's a whole lot of penalties to companies that you can't waste food. It's something Australia could definitely do, is put more pressure on the food supply chains that it's illegal to waste. And I think you'd see some very, very interesting changes from that. And that has to happen, because my observation from being part of that company was that the supermarkets just don't care. Their mindset, it comes from, we can put more pressure on farmers and get our things cheaper. That's how they operate as a business. Whereas there's a lot of other levers they could be pulling, but they're not, they haven't grown up with that mindset that if we reduce $1 billion of waste in our supply chain and sell some apples that are not so good at a lower price, we could make as much, they can probably make as much money or more by getting their supply chains and more efficient and reducing the waste, but it's just not the mindset that they have. They're looking for the opportunity to get produce cheaper and reinforce customer loyalty with little plastic toys and stuff. Not my favorite topic, let's say.
We won't stoke the flames too much there. So David, the one thing I also wanted to ask you is, I mean, in the past 10 years, what's the one innovative solution you've seen developed in the agriculture space that's really impressed you? Like, what do you get really excited about? Obviously, excluding the stuff you guys are currently doing as well, which, you know, we will be providing a lot of links to for everyone listening. But is there anything else that's really wowed you in the past 10 years that thought that, wow, that's a fantastic idea?
Yeah, without doubt, it's improving the microbiome in the soil is the topic that's become really hot lately. And there's more and more techniques to do that. And, you know, at the end of the day, everything in farm comes back to soil. If you've got good soil that is maintaining its nutrient levels, you can grow anything on it. And the soil will improve over time. So it's what crop, you know, the crops you put in the soil is one thing, but the things you can do to improve the soil, such as, you know, there's a great company we know called True Algae that makes massive algae farms for soil implements. And the results that they get are just amazing. Like, you know, substantial increases in fruit output, much healthier fruit, so much longer shelf life on the fruit. There's just like results all over the place when they do these things. And so we see technologies like that continually at these events. And again, it's one of the things that strikes me that everyone's not jumping over. I think it'll catch on soon. It's part of the whole regenerative farming thing. And I think that's where, you know, government investment could be really well placed to just bring a lot of those companies to Australia, because we have perfect situation to test them in, and then we can export those technologies to the rest of the world when they're fully developed. But yeah, without doubt, that's the big theme at the moment. Improve soil quality, inputs to soil, and the whole general regenerative farming theme.
I think, Carl, that's a common theme is Australia's a good R&D landscape, hey?
It is. And I think, you know, one of the big things that we're talking to a lot of people who have done, you know, VCs and running startups is we're in a unique position where you can develop ideas here really quickly. The problem's always been that springboard to the global market. Unless people have the connections or the roads, you know, if they're not supported, we've seen a lot of ideas, you know, jump and fall in the Tasman, in the ocean, and never get past the borders. So I think you are right, David. We do have a lot of land specifically that can be utilized here. We've got unique conditions, which are probably more in line with developing countries in Africa in regards to our climate and our land as well. So we could be that springboard that helps a lot of these developing nations actually, you know, provide more food globally, not just for their own countries, which can't be anything but, you know, a fantastic initiative. But yeah, a lot of the people we do talk to have sort of found that great ideas seem to die a lot quicker and more often, you know, within Australia than they do globally. And there's a lot of opinions and mixed reasons behind it, but it's also a bit of a sad sight to see. And I guess for your perspective as well, David, you're doing a lot of work overseas, but you have a fantastic team. But I mean, have you guys also seen the effect of kind of that brain drain? We've spoken to a few other people about it where, you know, people are just going, oh, I'm going to go straight to the States because I know I'll be able to get my funding. I'll be able to get this launched. And yeah,
we are so tempted to move to the States. At Unity, we'll raise investment. You know, we would immediately raise investment at a much higher value if we were to re-domicile to California. Not that it's a particular place I want to be right now, but there is a much more supportive environment. Funding's easier, connections are easier, and Australia needs. It would be great if Australia could improve that. We do continually hear this story, not so much in ag tech, but more in the fintech and other spaces. Companies, you know, once they get to a certain size, and they just go straight to California because there's funding there and the whole support infrastructure.
And what about the skill sets too for your team? Are you finding you can get everybody in Australia, or do you have to outsource overseas or leverage that? Or
yeah, you know, maybe I'm a bit biased, but you know, even when I worked at like Goldman Sachs, I frequently hired people direct out of Australia. So I think Australia has great technical resources. They just get all, you know, there's a continual drag overseas. Like we find a lot of great people. It's really good being in Gold Coast. Like a lot of people are very happy to come to Gold Coast because it's a, you know, it's a relatively cheap area to work. There's, you know, working in an innovative company in Gold Coast is kind of a dream if you're paying, you know, competitive rates. But yeah, at a senior level, there's definitely that drain to go overseas from Australia. But Australia produces really good people. And so we can find the people here, but yeah, there's always that drag on them to go overseas because it's not always the same level of opportunity here.
No, definitely. It's a common theme from a previous episodes discussing that. We do have upcoming episodes. We're talking with some of our university representatives to give us some insight on that too, from their opinion. So we interested to see that for sure. But just a question to close out. Obviously, you're using a mobile phone app when you're handing out the apps to farmers and so forth, and obviously making it affordable and simple. Developing the app, has that been a difficult task? The testing, the development, is there any challenges you've had with it? Or Carl and I know it well. It's a question we have to ask.
Yeah, don't get me started. The real challenge we had is because we're dealing with people that have mostly never had a phone before, we had a really unique testing environment because you can imagine a developing farmer in the highlands of New Guinea, never owned a phone before. Whatever we give them, they're going to say it's great for one or two reasons, because they've never seen anything else. So anything is great, but also because they've also got the impression that we're the people that build this, we should know that it works. So it's really hard to get feedback out of people. And John just did a fantastic job. Like just one of the anecdotes of when we started, the first thing we did was send the lawyer to go live in the jungle which just works on every level, right? You get him out of our hair, and he lived in a house with no proper floor and showered under a hose for a whole year, pretty much. But by doing that, he was with the farmers. They were coming to his house to have dinner. He was having dinner at their house. He knew them really well, and they would open up. And that's the only way we got to really understand how it needed to be done. And now we've got an incredible team member, Nuvitria. She's originally from Indonesia. She worked in Petra, who's our chief communication officer. Petra ran a really big NGO in Indonesia, and Nuvitria worked for her. So Nuvitria follows a human-centered design where the farmers basically co-design every deployment with her. So she'll step down, she'll map it out, she'll show them, she'll talk about how it could work better. And she's exceptionally good at extracting that information, as was John, but Nuvitria's, she's the artist at it. And so every time we go into a new country or a new commodity or a new village, we make sure that we send a team out, we spend the time sitting down and working with them, and we customize the whole solution. And that's part of what we've done. We've made the functions here easily replaceable. So we have different versions for everyone, and the system's designed to work that way, which is what you couldn't do developing an app in the normal way. You'd have multiple code, you'd have ridiculously forked code. So we spent a lot of effort in building, Unity's not an app, it's a platform. Part operating system, part super app, and then functional apps itself. And one of the things we're hoping to do in the future is open up the whole platform so people can build their own applets, use our whole back end without having to know anything about it. We can run hackathons or let people run hackathons where they just give every hackathon entry a phone and a shell application and go knock yourself out. The beauty of that is normally when you do a hackathon, you've got all the work to do to actually get it to people and consumer, to actually commercialize it. If we get a good result, we can deploy it to 1,000 farmers in New Guinea like the next week, and we can collect micropayments from them and actually make that business viable much more quickly than anyone else could. So we see a whole ecosystem developing in these applets to do discrete functions in specific markets, and we're working very hard to build a platform that can support that.
And is the plan then to allow other people to sort of jump on board and help you develop solutions on the platform as well in the future? So if someone comes along with something innovative, they can then drop it on and go, hey guys, I've got this great idea and I've already built it. And it's like, sweet, drop it on and let's go.
100%. And we're already working with a few like that. And the design of it is such that you only, like the only thing you need to do to be an icon in it or an applet is build the JavaScript user interface and all the functionalities in the back end. So they can build the JavaScript user interface really easy. It goes through our back end. It records the transaction on the blockchain. It can interact back and forth with the wallet. So for say, I want to pay for something, it can lock out that money in the wallet. And then we can call via web service to their back end and give them a fully completed transaction, so they don't need to do any of the comms, any of the security, all that sort out through them. And that's the idea, like once we get that basic platform into tens of thousands of farmers, it creates a huge opportunity for app developers. Rather than competing in a hotly contested market like Australia, there's 10 million people in New Guinea that you could deploy health applications to that have got nothing at the moment, and we can roll it out to many users. And I think that whole ecosystem, that's what will really drive the growth of AgUnity. Not what we do, but all the other features we can deploy and make it a phone that just does everything for a farmer the way a low-income farmer needs it to operate.
And with obviously with the low-income farmers, what sort of phones do you distribute to them?
In Kenya, we were getting this one, which is a Coolpad. We get these in bulk at about $20 US.
Okay.
That's about an iPhone 5, 6 level of phone. Like, it's amazing how cheap you get phones in bulk. Then when we went to this model, that's actually one of these. That's a Konka. These are a fully IP68 waterproof phone. You get them in bulk for $50. One of the interesting things we do, we almost always deploy the solution with the phone. You actually can make it downloadable. We tend not to, but it costs you more to help a farmer set up an application on a phone than it does just to buy the bloody phone. Yeah. So we're a bit distinct in that. And over time, we'll move to being more downloadable app. But right now, it's so much cheaper to just deploy a fully controlled environment, which you can then support. We can brick the phones remotely. We can update them as we need to. We know who's online, all that sort of stuff. It's much more functional to operate in a controlled way.
Do they feel empowered? So when you do hand them the phone, they start using it. What's the emotion like? Is it really just...
Oh, that's the best thing about the job. I love to go out when we're deploying the phones because you just get the most heartwarming comments from people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because, you know, normally it's people running a whole program and putting them in training courses. Like, I'm giving you a phone, and in a lot of the world, this 50, you know, these waterproof phones, the farmers, when we survey them, we don't tell them what the phones cost. We ask them what they think they're worth, and they come up to about $200 on average.
Okay.
That's what that phone would cost them in Ethiopia. So they think they've got treasure. You know, $200 a lot of money in Ethiopia. So they think they've just got something really awesome. It works, they understand it, and then it can do a whole lot of other things. So they're just, you know, literally out of their skins to do it and to get the phone. And then the most rewarding part of what we do as a company is actually getting out there, seeing them when they get it the first time, and more importantly, coming back a year later and they'll tell you how the village has changed, how we can do this, what's happening in the thing. And, you know, as much as you can earn big money in banking, I'd never do anything other than this. It's just the most rewarding job in the world.
Well, it's what it shows, like, obviously it's community, right? It empowers the community. It does so much of a knock-on effect to the positivity of what it does. So look, what you're doing is, from Australia too, I have to say, fantastic. And you're putting us on the map for all positive reasons, and you're really getting around. And look, you captured my imagination, I have to say. And it's only up from here for yourself. And there's a long way to go still, isn't there? You've got a lot of growth.
Yeah, there's about 1 billion farmers in our addressable market. So that'll take us a year or two. But yeah, no, we'll be moving into really big volumes in a couple of our markets now. And ultimately, we want to be hitting tens or hundreds of millions of farmers with this solution and become a true global platform. I think there's the need for it. And we've spent a lot of effort making a solution that can be a solution for millions, you know, many millions of people. And, you know, what a great thing to do. Just help in a small way, help millions of people, you know.
Big change comes from small steps at the start, right? So, yeah. David, exactly. David, just to echo Michael's sentiments and for myself, thank you very much for coming on today. It's truly amazing what you guys are doing. It is life-changing for so many people. We will be putting up, guys, a bunch of different links that give you a bit of information directly, not just about the company itself in regards to AgUnity, but also there are opportunities, obviously, to invest as well, David, I know, and also your contact details as well, just to, you know, for anyone who's very interested in the project and wants to get involved. For myself and Michael, you know, we can't say thank you enough for coming on today. It's been a fantastic experience, so thank you.
Well, likewise, it's a pleasure. You know, we're always honoured when we get represented in these forums. It's a great podcast, and we, you know, greatly appreciate to be on there. And just to add to the things you mentioned, we're also always looking for good people to join the organization. We're growing really rapidly, like, you know, a dozen new projects this year. So, you know, developers, people to go out in the field, where, you know, please come to us if you want to work for a meaningful company.
Well, note that for sure. Everybody jump on board. All right. Well, thank you very much. And we'll make sure to have you on again in the future to tell us, to give us some updates of what you're doing further.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. Goodbye.
Cheers, guys.
Wonderful. Thanks, Dave. Cheers. Bye.